Let's start off with this first concert, which is Jürgen Habermas still just about with us, hasn't departed the planet as yet. But this whole notion of what he came up with when he was talking about the public sphere. There he is. And this is probably his most famous book, The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere. Now, Jürgen was a member of the Hitler Youth, as many people were at that particular stage in late 1930s, early 1940s, Germany and so on. But as was the case with many Germans, post-war really wondered how this phenomenon of National Socialism could have become so corrupted, so perverted, so endemic to the sort of problematic aspects of the 20th century, how did it arise? And really one of his arguments about that, for the majority of the rest of his academic life, was spent coming to grips with this whole notion of some sort of form or fora of debate structure within the public sphere, which, as I say, finally received its English translation 20 years after it was written, actually, because it really didn't come into our current Western sort of culture until the 1980s, although the book itself was written in 1962 in the original German. And what was he actually talking about in that particular area? Well, there were a number of key aspects that he was relating to. First of all, Öffentlichkeit, openness, and the whole notion of citizenship. It was really looking back, what Habermas was doing was looking back to the ways in which in the Greek Empire, in Greek culture, there was clearly the notions of what it meant to be a citizen. How being a citizen really related to having certain duties, certain responsibilities, and so on. Now, one of the major challenges with that, of course, is that the Greek society was predicated on slavery being normal. But actually, clearly, there were certain people who, within Greek culture, had a right to speak, a right to comment, and so on, but there were many other folk who actually didn't. And he talks about this whole notion of the polis, the population, and the agora, the business side of things, the sort of thing that is culture and various other factors. And that's what Habermas kind of wanted to refer back to, this whole notion that there was an opportunity in a democratic society to have a platform and a fora where people could actually come together and work through that whole basis. Actually, it wasn't until the 17th century that you kind of see similar things beginning to merge again. Arguably, again, there was sort of notion there with respect to slave culture because slaves were big business. It's basically how Liverpool, Bristol, other port cities actually sort of managed to make their money. You can't have like three corners triangle, you get your spices and corns, you go to Africa, you slaves, you go to America, you ship them both, and you become very wealthy as a result. The other key thing to bear in mind when we talk about the public sphere is that actually there was very little currency given to what was a private life. The notion of individuals having privacy, unless you were really rulers, and even then, actually, if you were the ruler of a country, if you were the ruler of a whole region, basically everything was sorted out for you from, you know, dressing you in the morning, to coping with your ablutions, right the way through to putting you to bed at night. There's a whole range of things where basically you never really had any privacy as we understand it today. There was very much a kind of centralized sort of space which people would occupy and so on. But the public sphere as a concept began to develop through three key areas, three key aspects. First of all, in the Western world, for trade to develop, and for trade to spread, it needed information. Bear in mind from what we've said before that one of the elements of information, accurate information, is that that can be spread quite effectively by print, much more effectively than literally word of mouth or a predominantly oral-based culture. So we see the beginnings of news sheets and information relating to what's happening in various world-based markets. Do you, if you're a trader, actually equip a country with food if it's going through a famine? Or do you equip it with guns if it's actually going to war with its neighbour and actually can actually sell arms to its country? The Dutch in particular really developed a mercantile empire at this particular part of Western culture. And actually, in the 1700s, they were kind of invited in by the British Parliament to really look after the sort of sequences and so on, and basically take over elements within that. And gossip, which was very much, as we've already talked about, right at the heart of orality, actually became more formalised. As I think I mentioned before, Lloyd's of London, now a fairly renowned insurance broker, started off as a coffee purveyor. It was a coffee shop, a coffee house. It was because Lloyd at the time thought, actually, maybe there's some kind of currency to be made, there's some kind of profit, there's some kind of market for offering to insure ships. So if a ship actually sort of went down at sea or was lost, etc., was there a case of actually taking out insurance for that? You see the beginnings of the whole insurance mechanism beginning to come into place at this particular area. And certainly in addition to that, you've got the whole notion of the printed press, with journalists and so on, emerging as well. So we see the Times, the Telegraph and so on, really beginning to emerge to take advantage of this hunger for information. We talk about really ourselves are currently undergoing the IT revolution, the information technology revolution, and the currency of information is very much at the fore of this whole essence of what public sphere is about, what Habermas is relating to as well. So you're getting, as Jürgen said, a number of sort of key elements that are being developed here. Certainly things which hadn't really been seen before as far as the early part, or the sort of the first sort of 1,000 years, first millennium was concerned, and so on. You're getting a mixture of social areas, which could be salons, which could be coffee houses, which could be people where people, or places where people will gather together to actually talk about, you know, the latest fashions, the latest trends, the latest business elements that they're likely to be engaged with. And you're also getting printed information as well. Printed information in the form of critical journals, weeklies which actually purvey a style guide, a living guide. You're getting the onset of what would be seen as the first lifestyle advice magazines being developed. And in between both of those areas, those are the places for public discussion and the information for public consumption that's being put together. Collectively, both of those aspects are forming what we currently understand as the public sphere. And I'll show you again another sort of model in a few moments, which actually goes on to talk about how that public sphere has developed and evolved as well. And there it is. In the ancient Greek era, or the Romans, prior to that, you had the state, or the monarchy, or the kings, rulers of a particular state environment, and the serfs and the peasants and the individuals. And you would clearly actually get, you know, one line of direction, directive thought, things which were sort of deemed to be put in law or enacted, whether that was raising taxes, and people effectively had to cope with it accordingly. But one of the things that occurs with a growing mercantile class, a growing middle class, is you get the notion that if you are actually making a lot of money, should you have some sort of influence on what laws are being enacted? In other words, surely there's a kind of line and understanding that if you're paying all of the taxes for the government to actually fund the war against Napoleon in France, then actually maybe you want to have some sort of say in terms of how those taxes are being used in other areas. And you're seeing that third class system develop. Not only seeing the rulers, the monarchs, etc., you're also seeing this whole notion of people being represented in Parliament. The very famous Thomas Mann quote, which is at the heart of the American Declaration of Independence, is the notion of no taxation without representation. This was a period where America had effectively decided that they didn't wish to be a colony anymore, and actually being taxed on tea and various other things, and being ruled by a parliament that was literally across the ocean for them, was not really what they had intended when they actually sought out that whole notion of freedom, of human rights, and so on. And again, similar sort of thoughts are being seen within the French Revolution as well at this stage. So there's a lot of debate and discussion about where people actually sort of sit in this notion of the public sphere and how people are represented within them. That middle ground, as Habermas actually says, that really focuses on the whole sequence. And once again, there are three key elements that you can look at in terms of how this whole sequence was developing. We're talking here very much at the start of the 1800s, the late 1700s here. So it's the Georgian period. It's before we head into, obviously, the Victorian period of the 1800s and so on, and then the Edwardians in the 20th century and so on. So it's actually before all the things we talked about last week with radio and things were concerned. But, as we see, that initial stage is very much on commerce. It's the finance. It's where is the capital being developed? Where is the money coming from? And is that money coming in from taxes? Is it coming in from trade? Is it coming in from overseas developments and so on? How are things being grown from that? Probably the best example, which is still actually published today as a kind of commentary magazine, is The Spectator, which actually gives a whole range of advice for gentlemen in terms of the right clothes to wear, the right brothels to attend, the right lifestyles to sort of enhance, a whole range of sort of factors that come through within taste and fashion at the time. You know, what's the most popular coffee houses, what's the most popular ale houses to work into, and how to effectively capture information, and how to effectively be a better person, arguably. How to fit in with society, that whole notion. And as I've already mentioned, as finance has increased, as the nouveau riche develop, as we see the growth of the mercantile classes building their mills and begin to engage in the Industrial Revolution and so on, so too you're getting that line of the middle class wanting to become more and more involved with politics. Again, seen from Habermas's view, this is quite a good thing, but only if you actually get a relation where people can actually start talking about what it is they're getting involved with and so on. And so, as in any academic piece, and this is something to bear in mind when you're doing your essays at the end of the term of this module, or indeed any of your academic essays, let's look at what the good things are, and let's look at what the less good things are. What are the positives? What are the negatives? How do we actually translate those two? And I've kind of broken them down into two groups of three there, relating to what I'm referring to as Habermas refers to as the bourgeois public sphere, which is often used as a pejorative, but it's kind of where we sit in terms of middle class, etc. Well, one good thing is that ideally you can contribute to a debate or contribute to society based primarily on your intelligence rather than just having to have been born into a particular environment. Okay, so it's not necessarily just chance of hereditary or having to be the king of the country or the lord of the manor or the owner of the mill that effectively works through that. You do have that notion that you can contribute. However, the flip side of that is, if you're a woman, forget it. It's not going to happen. If you're non-white, it's not going to happen. Actually, in a large number of ratings, the only people who would actually be able to contribute would be white males who actually owned property. So, although on the one hand you say, yes, everybody's equal, but in the word of George Orwell in Animal Farm in the 20th century, all animals are equal, some animals are more equal than others. So there is a sort of challenge which is based within that. Secondly, a really good aspect is that when we start talking about how public opinion is formed, Again, it's really interesting when we look at the 21st century notion of nudge theory. How do you actually change people's habits and concerns? A piece this morning with one of the executives from Public Health England about how we need to avoid overusing antibiotics, because otherwise if we overuse antibiotics, our bacteria builds up an immunity to the antibiotics and they will no longer work. So how do we actually get people to sort of shift their habits of saying, oh, just give me some antibiotics and so on with respect to that? And so that whole notion of public opinion should actually be open to a debate. It should be open in a democracy to actually looking at what are the positives, what are the negatives, what are the pros, what are the cons. You need to have those balancing side of things and different voices to really address these things. Criticism can be seen as a useful thing, can be constructive. It's not just something where people say, do this because I'm telling you to do it. You know, one of those irritating questions can be why, but at the same time, in many cases, you need to answer that question. And actually, Habermas himself often tends to neglect what would be regarded as the more common-based open public spaces, pubs, and other sort of environment in terms of his views and ways that the views developed from that. Thirdly, in terms of the positives, you can actually find that in a public sphere, it does actually reflect the interests of the ordinary people. It's always dangerous when you start talking about the will of the majority, because indeed Brexit has actually proven, and still continues to do so. The countries voted for this. Really? 52% have, 48% haven't. That's not necessarily the country. But again, there's still a line there in terms of democracy. Is it the least worst of our public occupations, as Winston Churchill once said, in terms of politics? And one of the criticisms with respect to that is, why not have a series of public spheres, depending on what's being talked about? Whether that's sport, whether that's economics, whether that's commerce, whether that's fashion, what's trends, and so on. Should you actually restrict it to one singular sphere? I mean, that kind of model of state, individual, public sphere. Why not have several, depending on the circumstances, depending on what's being discovered or what's being discussed and considered and so on? So, that's all in place by the 17th century, the 18th century, and the 19th century. It's okay, so what went wrong? Why did we get to this stage whereby clearly, for whatever reason, the public sphere fell out of fashion for the majority of the 20th century? Well, maybe the first half of the 20th century. Although you could argue that in cases of North Korea, in cases of parts of Africa, in the cases of Romania, and etc., there are a whole range sort of issues where actually it's still sort of occurring. Even Vietnam. It's interesting that actually Vietnam evolved or took place because of French colonialism, ultimately. Well, there are three sort of aspects there, from academics who kind of come up with a range of sort of reasons in terms of why the public sphere isn't quite as positive as, or isn't quite as endemic as it used to be. First of all, ironically, it was the growth of the welfare state, national health insurance, and indeed major corporate bodies, IBM, Google, and of course prior to that, the likes of blue chip companies, Esso, Exxon Valdez, and so on, that actually led to a control of the public sphere. You know, the bigger the organisation, the more power, quote unquote, it would exert over its employees and indeed society. There's still that sort of notion in terms of, consider the sort of line of fracking. And the current sort of thing, if it's a good thing, is it a bad thing? How do you actually battle against the organisations to say, yes, you know, the government's in favour of, we should work through that, and so on. Secondly, because of the growth of the Fourth Estate, because of the influence of the press, because of the growth of mass media, as we talked about last week, you tend to get a situation where public opinion, again that very nebulous sort of aspect, tends to be formed by major multimedia organisations. You see things, you see a range of things actually there, you get a sense that that is the normal, the norm, that's the way things should develop, etc. And all we do as Joe and Josephine Hume public is literally just consume and look at what's happening. And it keeps us happy. It's the equivalent of sort of bread and circuses, really. You know, as long as we can kind of, we don't want to worry ourselves about various other factors. We just effectively sort of buy stuff, and if we want to be happier, buy more stuff, and so on and so forth. Now, both of those assumptions fit in very much with the Frankfurt School of Philosophy, of which Habermas was very much a key member. Max Horkheimer and Theo Adorno actually came up with this wonderful line called the Dialect of Enlightenment. The Dialect of Enlightenment. This whole notion that actually democracy, actually, no matter how well-intentioned the idea happens to be, can, without checks and balances, turn into fascism or dictatorship. And also the whole notion of the Enlightenment, of actually moving forward and progressing, etc., is actually perhaps viewed with a certain amount of scepticism. There's a line that I often tend to use when I'm defining what is a cynic, which goes something like, a cynic is somebody who, when they smell flowers, they look around for the coffin. Basis of, ooh, flowers, nice smell, who's died? There's always got to be a kind of sceptical sort of aspect to what we're talking about and so on. And the fact that ultimately you can sum up something else, which Horkheimer and Adorno were also talking about, which is the CBA line, which is can't be asked, can't be bothered. People are not bothered to actually get involved with what's involved. So it's apathy. Apathy rules. And actually that whole notion of an apathetic mass population drifting into whichever way people want to guide them is one of the things which is really at the heart of probably why this notion of an active public sphere declined. Where people sort of think, oh, well, what's the point? Why should we? Well, how can we actually change things and so on? So does that take us all the way back to what Habermas talks about in terms of the re-feudalization of the public sphere, something he was really concerned about? But we've had this brief moment of 150 to 200 years where there was a case of people, certainly in terms of the American dream, to actually pick themselves up by the bootstraps and actually sort of represent themselves and really become a part of society and develop that. Have we kind of simply replaced the barons, the monarchs, and the rulers of times past with the whole notion of mega corporations? Sony, Samsung, etc., etc. All the sort of lines that are, you know, the major big corporate owners like Google, Facebook, Amazon, and so on. You know, these giant companies who don't even have to pay taxes, you know, they're sort of worried, they set themselves up there, they pretty much do what they want. In other words, you're basing that on the commercial axiom. The notion that it's commerce which actually rules. The more money you've got, then the less control actually is offered. You also get that other middle line, which I've put down there. You get the whole notion of product is emphasized at the expense of content. Another way of actually saying that one is style over substance. But actually, as long as we're all wearing the same shoes and trainers because they're all comfortable, sorry, I couldn't resist listening to that, it doesn't make any difference. As long as, you know, they're made by some sort of, you know, poorly paid virtual slave somewhere in the Far East who's making the whole thing, why should we bother? You know, we've got great comfy shoes. So, Simon, all the rest of it's amazing. How does that tie into the notion of political spin? Well, nobody wants to really be seen as the bad guys. So one of the sort of elements of public relations, if you're working with large-scale companies, as opposed to, shall we say, not-for-profit organisations and so on, is maybe you have to find some way in which the message becomes more palatable. That actually the lines that are being said become, if not acceptable, the kind of people can actually say, oh, right, we understand what you're trying to do. It's not so much that people are being paid minimum wage for this, but you're actually feeding good things into the country and so on and so forth and so on. Now, give me just a couple of seconds to read this next one. Because I think this looks a lot more complex than it actually is. So I'll break it down once you've had just a moment to sort of read through the sort of elements which are within that. And I'll pick out a couple of key sort of aspects. So the first thing is communicative action. Actually, at its heart, being able to question the status quo, being able to actually question the things that we see, the things that we encounter, is fundamental to the process of democracy. Absolutely essential. It's fundamental to a line in which we do genuinely sort of start talking about people having equal rights, no matter what gender, race, etc., people happen to be. There is very indeed fundamental areas there which are pragmatic and key to the whole aspect. Secondly, if you start using rationality and beginning to explain the thoughts of Boris Johnson or Donald Trump or any of the Kim Jong-un, various other factors, or any of the politicians here, take Theresa May, Brexit means the Brexit. Actually start working through that whole process and start beginning to unpick what do these things actually mean. They often become seen as paper tigers. Actually, they are just slogans. You can't make arguments logically with slogans. And it's a way of, again, addressing that. Habermas refers to this as the ideal speech situation. It's effectively the time where people would turn around and say, excuse me, that's totally incorrect because of X, Y, or Z. And again, you're looking at a range of other elements within that. Now, inevitably, both of those tend to be ideals. Maybe they're also aspirational ideals. Maybe they are ideals that we tend to hope that we'll actually reach and actually get to. Maybe in the real world, we're never going to get to that stage where politicians will tell the truth, where business companies will tell the truth. Maybe you're still hung up on the debate of what is the truth? Where do we actually go from that? And no matter how much you try to employ legalistic frameworks to ensure that these things are the case, somehow there's always something that sort of seems to slip through the loophole and so on. And that's where we bring in this gentleman, John Thompson. A lot younger than Habermas, still around from this. Quoted in this wonderful media studies reader, the back end of the 20th century, with that wonderful essay, Mass Communication and Modern Culture. Now, Thompson is basically taking a different line to Habermas. Thompson's arguing that actually, because of the massive amounts of information we've actually got, because of the way people are consuming stuff from television, from radio, from the web, and so on, actually you need to have a different model. That notion of the public sphere is flawed. In theory, it's fine, but it doesn't really fit these key areas. And these are the zones where Thompson really takes issues with Habermas. First of all, why is he trying to reinvent the wheel? You've always had gatherings of human beings. Human beings are intrinsically social animals. They gather together. You've always had people who've complained about society. Why should you artificially look to incorporate them into society when they're already there? Also, I mentioned at the start that Habermas was very much concerned about preventing or avoiding any situations that occurred with Nazism in Germany and fascism in Europe. And as a result of that, and because he was part of the Frankfurt School, which was very much a Marxist political school of thought, he actually would avoid or actively ignore some of the less political texts that might be agreed as being part of the real influences of society relating to things such as popular culture, popular music, fashion, all these kind of areas, which arguably have a massive impact in terms of what people actually sort of move to work through and so on. And arguably going to have lots of influence. It's interesting, when the Beatles were at the height of their fame, there were a number of people who were arguing that there was far too much hysteria, mass hysteria, and the sense of what would happen if you actually had folk other than the Beatles who were manipulating audiences to this huge end of political hysteria and so on. Obviously the echoes 20 years after the Nuremberg rallies and so on kind of carried through on that basis. Thompson is also concerned that if you do focus just on mainline politics, because of reasons such as apathy and so on, access tends to be limited, so they're not really public as such. And finally, he's also concerned that Habermas spends too much time focusing on the decline of the public sphere, the end of the public sphere, rather than actually how it's changing and evolving, how it's actually becoming more developed in terms of what we see and so on. So, you've got your Thompson in one corner, you've got your Habermas in the other corner. And this is one of the key questions that's being addressed. You know, before we start going into the cinema, television, all the other sort of elements that come across with this, do we actually still have what can be called a public sphere? Well, let's again start looking at it from the point of view of identifying some of the key characteristics of the area. First of all, if there's one word I'd like you to take away from today, sort of 5% being around, noted out, etc., it would be this word here, indeterminacy. You will find you'll be using that word quite a number of times during the course of the programme of public relations at degree level. Because it does mean, ultimately, in terms of indeterminacy, there is a lack of certainty in terms of what we actually see being developed at any particular stage. A lack of certainty, as you'd always expect when you get polarised opinions. Whether you're a major ecologist, believing in the Green Movement, the Green Party and so on, whether you're a regular traveller who likes to put their carbon footprint on, there's some sort of mid-range that comes through. The other characteristic of mass communication is kind of self-evident. There's a lot of it. You know, you can, two or three clicks, find a whole stack of information about Habermas, about Thompson, about the public sphere, about the history. You can go into Thomas Mann, you can go into the American Revolution, you can go into the French Revolution. There's a lot of stuff out there. Part of what I do in this lecture is hopefully filter through some of the key elements and kind of give you some of the main headlines, the broad headlines that are actually out there. But ultimately, because of the very nature of the beast, as information storage increases, from the point of view of megabytes, gigabytes, terabytes, and so on, you need to sift through that. Remember what I said a few weeks ago about Erasmus, Francis Bacon, the last people who kind of generally regarded as knowing pretty much everything about everything? It's just not possible these days. Because you can have access to that information, you're not necessarily going to be an expert on those particular areas. So generalism is certainly to the fore there. And whatever your political leanings, information is power. Knowledge is power. It can be sold. It can be sold in terms of the way that the phone companies actually sort of charge a specific tariff for usage of access to the web, whether that information is how many funny animal videos can you actually download, whatever level you're actually talking about, it's still being packaged and repackaged and sent to you. Similarly, if you take out subscriptions to music channels, to film channels, all of that is part of the commodification. And it's also being challenged because of, clearly, things like paywalls, things like, you know, whether it's Wikipedia, whether it's Guardian online, putting up sort of lines of, please make a donation. Going to keep going if you can actually send money to us, etc. Anybody ever take part in any crowdfunding campaigns here? No? Oh, right. Have you heard of crowdfunding? Okay, so yeah, again, it's all part of that whole vision of how things can be developed, packaged, and put together and sold to us. And finally, key characteristic of mass communication, it's pretty much available 24/7 whenever you want it. Now, I say pretty much because obviously the Wi-Fi could go down, all sorts of other issues relating to transmitter things. There are still issues around that, but broadly speaking, in urbanized environments, in Western civilization, and indeed beyond that, you can pretty much access things as and when you want. Whether or not you want to spend sort of a lot of time on hold listening to music being played whilst you're sorting out insurance quotes, but still, never mind, that's another lie. Okay, so coming on to a couple of people who came up with another aspect, and again going back to that opening sort of piece where we started off with Habermas, talked about Thompson. I want to introduce these two writers to you now, who very much emerged in the post-World War II environment, at the heart of the advertising area, the notion of Madison Avenue. Anybody ever seen Mad Men? Yeah? It comes out of the basis of basically being based in Madison Avenue, the whole marketing system. And marketing and advertising is all about this whole notion of influencing people. Influencing people to buy things, persuading them that effectively whatever they're doing is wrong, that they can be a better person, if they can actually buy this, that, and the other. All these kind of techniques. I mean, the actual sort of, look inside the title, as you can see, personal influences. Lots of people talking. Is anybody listening? Are we simply getting a whole range of things working through to actually see what messages are coming across? And Lazarsfeld and Katz came up with what they thought was actually a kind of improvement on this whole notion of the public sphere side of things, and they came up with that. Okay? The two-step flow model. And again, as with most theories, there's an intrinsic elegance to this which is worth sort of accessing. First of all, it brings into base the notion of opinion leaders, the people who are at the top of the hen house, the people who actually are the peak of their profession, the cocks of the farmyard, if you like. They effectively sort of come up with your lines there. Experts, folk who actually work on the premise of really specialising things. At one level, you get this kind of interaction. No real validation, no real commitment, but at the same time, somehow, it's got the same sort of validity as saying, well, if it's in the papers, it must be true. If it's printed, it has to be true. This notion of what is truth, what's coming through, what messages are coming through from that basis. And what Katz and Lazarsfeld really work through is this development of the two-step flow method. They take as a starting point at the left-hand side there, the far left-hand side, the notion of the mass media. Although this is written predominantly before the rise of the internet, so it's referring in terms of press, radio, and television and film, arguably it still can be adapted to what we use with respect to the internet as a different media form and so on. But ultimately, the presence in the media and the amplification of particular viewpoints and strategies provides us, the public, with opinion leaders. People who will be sought out for their particular opinion on some particular aspect of society. Whether that's relating to political issues, whether it's relating to fashion, whatever. It's the thing that consistently you get in 24-hour rolling news now, where experts are brought into TV studios and radio studios and effectively asked what are their views on a particular topic and so on. Sometimes they might be right, sometimes they might be wrong and so on. Now, in certain instances, that can be completely unmediated because it goes directly from the media all the way through to the individual and the message is taken from source. Fantastic. But what Katz and Lazarsfeld also talk about is the notion of how things can actually change. how listening to your peers, listening to your friends, listening to other people that you might trust, your parents, other sort of folk, people relating to particular environments and so on, you could say at one level, this is the real challenge with the courage that we're concerned about radicalisation. That somehow, with respect to this level, the range of individuals receive messages that are somehow distortions of what happens to be perceived as the case, may well be sort of that they have their own sort of viewpoints, etc. So it's not an ideal area, but it does exist from there. So, let's just go back to a couple of the sort of key things here. What have we actually reached from this whole notion of mass media and the public sphere? Well, I think we're kind of all agreed that there is one, a public sphere. I'll probably go further and say actually there are several public spheres that exist in terms of a system of that. It's worth noting in terms of this particular aspect that there are three key theorists, four actually in terms of obviously Katz and Lazarsfeld, who really impact in terms of what they see the public sphere as working, how it's being developed and so on. And what I'd like here to look at between now and tomorrow is consider a particular aspect of social debate that could be Brexit, it could be fracking, it could be anything you want, basically. But basically just see which one or ones of Habermas, Thompson, Katz and Lazarsfeld the thing can actually apply to. How can you actually apply the theory to the practice? Now, maybe to, you might have something that's perfectly easy, it fits in perfectly well. It can be anything from Adidas footwear right the way through to the whole notion of Benetton and We Are and a whole variety of sort of things. In other words, think about when marketing campaigns or public campaigns actually have had issues. Recently we've had the Dove issue, we've had Pepsi, we've had a variety of other things where things have been sort of going out into the media that actually we thought, I don't know, where does that sort of fit in? And really we'll talk about how that can either be helped or sorted out by using some of the sort of previous theorists that we've actually taught, or at least understood, because at the heart of all of this is getting to the notion of understanding how these things work. And that's at the heart, and that's why Thompson, Katz, Lazarsfeld, all of these, all four of those folk, are people who, and their successors in the 21st century, have all kind of worked on the basis of trying to use the social sciences to fix, in inverted commas, society's ills, or to apply techniques that can be used to make sure that we are having a better, more productive, more well-rounded society, etc. The question I'll be putting to all of you tomorrow is that the case, or are we kind of just doomed to kind of literally just reinforce our mistakes of the past and so on? Has anybody got any questions about what I've talked about? I appreciate it. This is probably the densest lecture we actually provide for you in terms of theoretical content within the module. We talk a little bit more about the mass media, obviously, and subsequent things. Anybody got any burning questions at present? All okay? Excellent. Well, with 46 minutes clocked up, it's time to say farewell, and I will...